take care, y'all. Up next is Right on Radio.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Welcome, welcome, everybody. Welcome to Right on Radio. We are at KFAI FM in the Twin Cities, 90.3 FM. And today, my guest is Dr. Simon Calder, a man who's writing a self-published book called Her Hummingbird Heart, which we'll get into shortly. Welcome, Simon. It's so good to have you.
Hi, Cook. It's so great to be here.
Yes, here being KFAI, of course. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is our pledge drive week, spring pledge drive. And so if you're so inclined, click kfai.org and click donate. And we would love it if you could help us out a little bit. So, Simon, tell us just a little bit about what you're working on and what the history of that has been.
Excellent. Okay. Well, so Dr. Calder, the character who is working on this book, Her Hummingbird Heart, moves to Minneapolis from England after completing his PhD in the English department there. It's on literature and philosophy. And I'm talking about myself in the third person here, but that's something.
Well, it's creative nonfiction, so.
Yes, exactly. Yes. It definitely is that. And it's a book about harnessing creativity. So, and
okay. That's going to be really important later on here as we get into it.
And also, there's a meta level insofar as the character. The main reason I've started talking about the character, Dr. Simon R. Calder, who's working on the book, Her Hummingbird Heart, is that by this point, as I'm turning back to the book and I'm some way into successfully landing the final form of it, it has evolved into a book called Our Hummingbird Hearts.
Ooh, okay.
And it involves a character who, in the third of four distinct time frames that we visit in each of the 10 chapters, the character Dr. Calder thinks that he's wrapping up a book called Her Hummingbird Heart in the third time frame.
So, and in a way, the book is a little bit about the book.
The book, one of the things that the book is about is the process of writing a book, but more broadly, the process of writing on, metaphorically as well as literally, recommitting to a project and then allowing the project to evolve. This one evolved so much that the title changed slightly. And another way in which it evolved as I recommitted to it is whereas initially it was Her Hummingbird Heart was a book that brought Sarah Morris, who listeners might be aware of, is a Twin Cities sort of Minnesotan musician.
An old backpack's riding shotgun and the floorboards holding her guitar. She knew what to take and what to leave behind. Yeah, she's good at goodbye. She's on the shortcut to the highway with the window rolled down. She rests her head on her left hand.
I have my own interview show, Back to the City, and she'd been on it a number of times. And in interviews, long-form interviews with Sarah, I learned a lot about Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way and Brené Brown, was in turn very influenced by those authors, was inspired to write a book that was drawing on my methodology from my PhD thesis, but had the focus and the values of the Back to the City TV show, where I was applying the same kind of focus that I did in the PhD to humans that I was engaging with as a musician in the Twin Cities music scene. So it began as a book that was acknowledging the great influence of The Artist's Way and Brené Brown on Sarah Morris, but treating Sarah Morris and Sarah Morris's music specifically as a case study, seeing how music, a collection of songs, a body of songs that was influenced by the theory of wholehearted living that we encounter in The Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown, what happens when that theory is put into song. There are some songs, there's some music by Sarah Morris and by other artists where I can see a very clear, intentional nod to, say, Brené Brown. But then there's other songs of Sarah Morris's where I could see an exploration of a theme, say the theme of play, which is one of the guideposts, the wholehearted living for Brené Brown, where Sarah's music was reaching beyond the theory. And that's what I was interested in. The Doctor called her in Her Hummingbird Heart, the Doctor called her in the book Our Hummingbird Hearts, who's writing a book called Her Hummingbird Heart, is interested in how music and songwriting and creativity pushes beyond theory, even as it is indebted to life-serving theory such as Brené Brown's guidepost, The Wholehearted Living.
That sounds fascinating and a bit complex.
Yeah.
Who are the audience for this?
That's a really good question.
Pick up this book.
So I started working on the book Her Hummingbird Heart during the pandemic, which is the second of four time frames in the book that I'm landing now, Our Hummingbird Hearts, which hopefully appeals to a much broader audience. It's a lot more silly, even though the theory, like the intellectual and existential weight of it, I think is, I'm prouder of it. And the commitment to playfulness that was always theoretically there is far more actualized. And so I'm hoping that people who know me as the host and producer of the Back to the City TV show would find content that is relatable to them if they like those long-formed interviews that I conduct with musicians.
Which, by the way, that is Back to the City MPLS on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So you can actually even find the Hum documentary there. If you put Back to the City MPLS into YouTube and then search the playlists, so you'll find something called Simon's Hum documentary, which was a 10...
H-U-M.
H-U-M, yes. Yeah. So actually, that's a key part of the story. When I thought I was landing Her Hummingbird Heart in the form of it being a somewhat scholarly, back to your question, it was very much modeled on my PhD thesis methodology. There I was taking the fiction of the 19th century novelist George Eliot, who wrote Middlemarch, Middle on the Floss, but who also translated Spinoza's Ethics and Feuerbach's The Essence of Christianity into English for the first time before becoming a novelist, and who also edited the Westminster Review and was engaged to marry Herbert Spencer. And I think, you know, was intellectually so much more interesting than Herbert Spencer. Anyway, she turned to writing novels as the way to express her sense of life in a way that was informed by philosophers that her peers were not engaging with in anything like the depth that she was. But you don't need to know that to reckon with the sense of life that we encounter in Middlemarch, say, which Virginia Woolf said is one of few novels written for grown-ups. And in my thesis, I was bringing this scholarly awareness of the complexity and the unusualness of Spinoza's philosophy in particular to my reading of George Eliot to emphasize to laymen what the influence was, why it was interesting that George Eliot was reaching beyond Spinoza in the ways that she was. Spinoza wouldn't write novels. He would consider novel reading to be something that keeps us embroiled in our servitude. He's interested in freedom and a certain type of creativity, but not the type of creativity that leads to novel reading and being overly emotional in terms of the passive affects.
Almost a form of just entertainment.
He would dismiss it as
maybe cheap in a way.
Cheap entertainment, and worse than that, it would help us, it would keep us essentially addicted to certain passive affects, he would call them, fear. So for a start, anything in a novel that isn't real, and we would be wasting our energy in caring about Dorothea Brooke.
This sounds like somebody in our times blaming somebody for watching way too much Netflix, right. Almost.
This is a starting point in our hummingbird hearts. It takes as a given that we are all creatures of habit. Like Aristotle knows we're creatures of habit. Spinoza knows we're creatures of habit. And there are... there is a certain type of creative living. Spinoza gets a shout out in the opening chapter of The Artist's Way, which is about, like our hummingbird hearts, it's about committing to creative living and becoming free from whatever mind-forged manacles are holding us back from flourishing and co-creating and living a fulfilled life.
That's The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron,
yeah,
correct?
Absolutely.
I suspect a lot of our listeners who are avid readers will have heard of that. But if you haven't, The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron has a framework that helps you get up and going creatively.
At the end of the first time frame in our Hummingbird Hearts, which goes right up to the pandemic, I am working as a barista at Common Roots Cafe, thanks to my friend Krista, who set me up there, because I don't want to have to monetize the Back to the City TV show. So it's an expensive hobby back at that time. And I'm working at the cafe in the morning before teaching at the university in the afternoon to make it possible. And Andrea Swenson, another then radio host who would interview many of the same musicians as me, came in one morning and ordered a bagel and was very surprised that Dr. Simon Calder from the university, but Dr. Simon Calder 1.0 is Dr. Calder because he has a PhD from Cambridge and he teaches full-time at the university. And Andrea Swenson's bemused. You know, why is this interviewer of Minneapolis musicians who she knows is a full-time professor, why is he serving me coffee? And I explain it that, you know, I'm trying to maintain my commitment to Back to the City in this way. And actually, I want to... It happens to be the case that this is going to be my final semester at the University of Minnesota because they don't need... the lower level writing class that I'd been teaching for almost a decade, semester in, semester out, they were restructuring the curriculum and they didn't need so many people to teach that particular class.
You were teaching for a while when you moved from the UK. It wasn't just a year or two.
Yeah,
I didn't realize that it was quite a few years.
2010 is when I completed my PhD and both the States and England were reeling. Arts and humanities departments in universities were reeling after the economic crisis. So although I had completed my PhD in 3 years and I'd been the English faculty graduate student representative, and then the arts and humanities graduate representative on the board, I was very focused on my scholarly work and lining myself up for an academic career. But then there were so few jobs. I wound up moving with my then partner to the U of M. She was a tenure track professor, and I was expecting to be an adjunct lecturer who had moved here as part of a partner hire. I thought we'd be here for a couple of years, 3 years. She was applying for other jobs too. I fell in love with the music scene, and by the time that she found the job that she preferred elsewhere, we had broken up and I stayed here. Fast forward to the pandemic, it's like a decade, I'm still here. by that point. But I'm serving coffee to Andrea Swenson in the coffee shop and saying that my time as a university lecturer is coming to a close, and I'm planning to spend some time with my parents, who I've barely seen in the last decade. I'm going to visit them for 2 months, which seems like a long time, and I'm going to start working on a book. And I haven't decided what the book's going to be yet, but I know...
Just 2 months, right?
Yeah, just 2 months. It ends up being 18. That's the whole second... 18 months, the whole second time frame in the book consists of me being stuck because we have a much harsher lockdown in England. My parents have moved to the countryside, to Dorset, Charmouth, Dorset. It's not where I grew up. I don't know anyone else there apart from my parents. And I moved there with this intention to write something. And initially I'm thinking maybe I should publish a slightly more readily, a broader audience form of my PhD thesis on George Eliot. Initially I was thinking maybe I should return to that material and write a relatable book about, given that the focus of it was that George Eliot was using this popular form of the novel so that she would... the relationship with the public would be different. She would have more impact. She would have a greater impact on the inner lives and the potential for freedom of the readers if she wrote novels. So it struck me I should take what I was doing in my thesis. That seemed important to me. I should write about it in a form that's relatable and maybe publish that.
This idea came as you were midway through that 18-month stint back
it
home in the
UK. Actually near the beginning, and something that happened right before the stint, the 18-month stint, back to serving Andrea Swenson coffee. When I mentioned to her that I wanted to revive writing, because right a decade ago, when I was landing my PhD thesis, writing was central. And I had taught lots of writing classes, but I hadn't been doing very much writing.
Oh, okay.
So she recommended The Artist's Way to me as the book that had been the catalyst for her as a writer. She'd published multiple books by this point, and she was, and that was going so well that she was about to move away from the primary thing that she was, that she had been doing, was interviewing artists. That was how we knew each other. We were interviewing the same artists. We'd often read one another's or listen to one another's interviews to help us prepare. Now, she'd moved away from that, and she was becoming a full-time or primarily an author. She said the catalyst was The Artist's Way, so I bought it. And then the following day is when news of the pandemic leading to lockdown. And I had to move all of my stuff into storage, and Venus de Mars drove me because international flights were being cancelled. My job at the university that my health insurance was tied to was about to end. So I almost got stuck in a foreign country, for me, the States, at the beginning of an unanticipated global pandemic without a job or health insurance. And it was a couple of months earlier, a month and a half earlier than it would have been, and that began the 18 months.
And do you discuss this in part of the book, or will you, as the draft unfolds?
Absolutely, yeah. That is...
Because that's a pretty pivotal moment in your story that you weave throughout this framework of our hummingbird heart.
Exactly, yeah. There's 10 concepts that the evolved form of the book deals with, and they are in the order that they're dealt with, in the order of the chapters: work, play, music, resilience, faith, growth, calm, method, power, and love. Initially, in her Hummingbird Hearts, the 10 guideposts to wholehearted living from Brené Brown with the 10 different chapter themes, and I found myself concluding that Sarah Morris was exploring territory and beginning in the territory of the theory in each case, but going beyond that. It struck me recently that I'd moved so far beyond the guideposts that it would be a better structuring device for the book would be these core areas of life, these concepts. And in each chapter, there's essentially an anecdote from a different part of my life from these four different time frames, looking at work in chapter one through the lens initially of that pre-pandemic life, where my work life consisted of completing 3 degrees, and then moving to Minneapolis, and whatever meaningful work I was doing related to music, such as the Back to the City TV show or making records or whatever, was something that I was doing in my free time whilst I was a full-time professor. And then that time frame gets interrupted by the pandemic, and what I thought would be 2 months of visiting my parents and beginning to work on a book that would have been more scholarly, would have been more Dr. Caldery, probably would have been about George Eliot and Spinoza. But instead, I'm being recommended The Artist Way by Andrea Swenson was a key part too, because, you know, The Artist Way is a course in higher creativity as well as a book. So I had just begun the course when I needed to relocate to England, and it was upon completing that course that I decided to, first of all, bring back the Back to the City TV show whilst being stuck in England, because everyone would have been interviewing one another on Zoom anyway, if that's what I was doing if I was in Minneapolis. And then the interview that I did with Sarah Morris about an EP that she was putting out is what was the catalyst, the ultimate catalyst for her Hummingbird Heart, because Sarah was talking about The Artist's Way again. She was talking about Big Magic again, all of the texts that she'd brought up in the prior interviews. She recommended Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, which ends up being where Brené Brown gets the idea of composing a stormy first draft. That starts off as a heuristic for just writing, getting words down on the page. But for Brené Brown, it becomes a tool for recognizing the limited story that I'm telling myself about myself and opening oneself up to revising it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was doing The Artist's Way. I was completing The Artist's Way course, and then I realized more the prospect of shifting the case study from being George Eliot and what happens when George Eliot writes novels that are informed by Spinoza's theory. That seemed less alive to me than the prospect of considering what happens when, you know, I'm a musician myself, what happens when a musician is explicitly, consciously influenced by a certain theory of how to live.
Zooming out a little bit, it looks like you're taking this autobiographical platform, but weaving in the theories that have influenced you, your writing, your songwriting throughout the years, and how that those interplay with how you live according to those guideposts. Mm-hmm. Is that a good, fair kind of summary of what it looks like?
If George Eliot was to be the case study of the book that would have been just the book of my thesis, and Sarah Morris was the case study in her Hummingbird Heart, then I end up being the primary case study in our Hummingbird Hearts, even though there's also Sarah Morris, even though there's Kirk, even. Kirk will make some appearances in our Hummingbird Hearts.
I make an appearance? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a surprise to me.
Yeah, more than one. And the reason why the case study ends up being me, even as we have this broader cast of characters, is that given that this book, like Brené Brown's text, is a creative self-help book of sorts, there's no like pat lessons, but it does propose, especially in the later chapters and the chapter concerning method, it does propose a method for living. And each chapter will have a QR code at the end of it, and someone can go down that portal to encounter Dr. Simon R. Calder himself. Like guided meditations, guiding the interested reader, if the reader chooses to participate, through some writing exercises.
So this is very interactive the reader wants.
If the reader wants.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also, I've revived my illustrating. As a kid, I used to really like drawing cartoons. And so each of the 10 chapters also now involves an illustration by myself. If the something I realized just in the process of preparing for this interview with you, Kirk, is that whereas Her Hummingbird Heart, with the hummingbird reference in the title, was lightly advocating for something we could call the hummingbird path, Our Hummingbird Hearts is more wholeheartedly doing that. But rather than simply proposing that this hummingbird path, whatever it is the right path for anyone who wants to be creative, it presents it as involving a set of commitments that are likely to lead to certain results that have positive and negative sides. So something that happens in the third time frame is that as I return to Minneapolis and think that I am about to land Her Hummingbird Heart, and then I join the songwriting challenge and I write 10 songs that are the record hum, and then I release that, and then I start organizing all kinds of other events at the VFW, which is where the record release happened. I also meet the love of my life and fall in love, and then adopt a whole family with three kids. And it's no surprise that although I keep on being creative and writing songs, the mammoth book doesn't get written. Her Hummingbird Heart never gets written.
Creativity has potentially a darker side.
Yes, and I discovered this once I have the commitment to a partner, and to a partner with children who I choose to step into the role of being. Beatrice, you know, called me a bonus dad. So
a once, bonus dad.
Bonus dad, yeah. And so once I, and I've become that, and a true friend, I would like to think, to each of those kids. And that has been a core commitment for me, and I am aware of that being even more of a commitment. My commitment to those humans, I would go so far as to say, is deeper than my commitment to Our Hummingbird Hearts, say. And actually, I think it's making it easier to write Our Hummingbird Hearts now in the kitchen of the family. Presently, the place where I'm making the most fruitful progress with my writing since returning to Minneapolis years ago, is the family kitchen, a corner of the family kitchen. And my awareness of the commitment to that household and the values of the household, which include play. I have Mr. Ducky with me here in the studio with us.
It looks like a little neon orangish greenish puppet duck with a very cartoonish broad orange bill.
Yeah.
And two button eyes.
Absolutely. I have him and I have Harry, who is a hummingbird that Beatrice and Fiona and I acquired along with this hummingbird notebook that I also have in the studio with us. We acquired all of those on January 2nd, 2026 at the Como Zoo. And I went into the new year with knowing that I was writing a book called Our Hummingbird Hearts, determined to land it that year, determined to ensure safety and security and a loving environment for my family, and to not have my commitment to writing get in the way, I didn't want stress about writing and the sense of pressure to write to interfere with my family life. And then all kinds of stuff happened in January in Minneapolis for all of us, and then it affected my work in ways that stressed me out so much. When one of the physical manifestations that occurs when I get stressed is a sebaceous cyst starts growing out the back of my neck. And so that was happening, and I discovered during my time in England, those 18 months, that if I just really, I've had the opportunity then to take lots of baths, to meditate, to do Wim Hof breathing, to journal, to relax. And just Brené Brown theorizes that rest is one of the commitments, one of the guideposts the whole house of living. I discovered in practice that if I rested, that sebaceous cyst, which would otherwise be involve a costly operation to remove, I could use the power of intention and meditation and my commitment, my true commitment to rest and self-love to cause the stress to go down and the cyst to go down.
Wow.
But the cyst came back in January 2026 when I had this, we got Harry the hummingbird. I've got my notebook where I was calling it the playbook because I was, it was playful.
Uh-huh.
There's like little, there's a sticker of a little Mr. Ducky on it. And so we're heading back from home, Como Zoo. Beatrice wanted me to sit in the back with her. We're making Harry the hummingbird fly. I've got my book in which I'm going to write my notes on play, the book called Play that influences what Brené Brown has to say about play, the guidepost to the wholehearted living and the gifts of imperfection. I'm going to take my notes on that book. Here they are, Tuesday the 2nd. And then all of this stressful stuff happens and I'm at an interface with me being able to work on the book. But the playfulness and the commitment to the family, and I'm going to show up and we're going to go to Como Zoo, and it's going to be a nice experience for the 7-year-old. And then when she starts her first basketball tournaments, we're going to go to every game, even though the Minneapolitans are under attack with the occupation. It's still, this is the only time that Beatrice has her first ever basketball game, and it's important, you know, for like in our hummingbird hearts, I theorize that play and commit and it's important for a child's sense of identity to have their thing and to be supported. And so as I found myself in the context of my family, becoming aware, thanks to applying something like Brené Brown's Rising Strong method, something like it that is my own version that's theorized about, yes, in the later chapters of this book. As I found myself applying that and remaining in alignment despite these impediments, remaining committed to the family, committed to play, committed to love, then I thought, okay, this is a book that I'm now the person that can write this book.
Excellent. And now we're going to take a little brief break for a couple of messages. You're listening to 90.3 KFAI FM in the Twin Cities and streaming online at kfai.org. And also, this is Pledge Week of the spring, so if you're so interested, go to kfai.org and click Donate. We would really appreciate it. When we get back, we will talk a little more about process and how the interplay between life and life balance and the work itself plays into the process, and also a little bit more about the self-publishing process.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center, presenting Yasmin Williams, Sunday, April 19th. Williams is a guitarist capable of playing many other instruments. Her music sways from folk to soundscapes. Joining her on the stage is singer-songwriter Nathan Graham, who bridges the blues with Americana. More information about Yasmin Williams is available at thecedar.org.
Hey, neighbor. West Bank staple and one of the few existing small stages in the area, Acadia Cafe, is asking for community support. On April 1st and 2nd, starting at 8 p.m., join us for music, drink, and song to keep Acadia Cafe going strong. AcadiaCafe.com for more details.
Support for KFAI comes from the Berlin Music Lounge, presenting the Cecil Alexander Trio, Thursday, March 26th. Guitarist Cecil Alexander, drummer Danny McGonigal, and bassist Rob Linton come together to present two sets of jazz originals and reinterpretations from the Great American Songbook. Cecil is known for his versatility as a guitarist, from complex bebop lines to rock-like synchronization. More information about the Cecil Alexander Trio is available at BerlinMPLS.com.
What do you think of when I say spring?
Spring break.
Spring fever.
Spring cleaning.
How about spring member drive?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Well, the KFAI Spring Member Drive is on right now. So go to KFAI.org and click Donate to help keep non-commercial, community-powered radio going strong. It's your time to spring into action.
Oh, I see what you're doing there.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Kirk Clocky, for Right On Radio here at KFAI in the Twin Cities, KFAI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities, and streaming online at kfai.org. Welcome back, Simon. This is my guest, if you're just joining us, is Simon Calder, the author of the upcoming book, Our Hummingbird Hearts, and the book is in process. Correct.
It is very much in process, yes.
This part of the hour, we're going to talk about the process of writing the book and also the fact that it's self-published, correct?
Yep.
It's going to be. And how you kind of balance living a very busy life with the writing and where you do the writing, when you do the writing, how mm-hmm. you're going to make this happen, because it's a heavy lift. We all know that if we've tried to write even a shorter piece, not no less a book, it's a heavy lift. And getting it off the ground and then doing all of the publication, marketing elements. So how is that all working out now, and where are you at in the process?
That's a very good question. So when I first returned to Minneapolis with the intention of writing what was then Her Hummingbird Heart, I thought that I needed an isolated writing space. And this was informed by books like Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott.
Uh-huh.
And so you, in fact, encouraged me to join you at a co-working space. And I found it very productive to lock into writing there when I was at that location, which was in Uptown. I would consistently sit in the same place and have my writing time.
And this is a co-working office, but instead of at shared tables, you had upgraded to a private, semi-private office within that space so you could close the door and mm-hmm. have your writing space apart from family, apart from friends.
Yep. And at that point, I didn't have a partner, certainly didn't have children in my life. I was living with my musician friend, Darren Jackson, a.k.a. Kid Dakota. And I really could, in retrospect, have written the book in my bedroom. But I was so aware that having a dedicated space and total seclusion, I felt that would help. And it did to some extent. And that's why I graduated from the open workspace to a very small office. And the reason why having uh-huh. the office really worked was because back then, Her Hummingbird Heart was more scholarly. I had so many books that I was referencing. I was engaging with very specific aspects of, for a start, Brené Brown's theory, but specific passages in But the Body Keeps the Score, for example. So I felt like I needed to have all of those books on hand. So I had a bookshelf behind me that was split into 10 different subsections related to the 10 chapters of Her Hummingbird Heart. And okay. I just had that all set up. I'd started doing ITF workshops. You experienced the beta group of that. ITF is Integrate, Transform, Flourish. And that's coming back as well, these e-courses and guided writing exercises that readers of chapters of our Hummingbird Hearts are invited to engage in. At the end of each chapter, that is the return or the real landing of ITF, these courses that help people use writing exercises to commit to work, play, music, resilience, faith, growth, calm, method, power, love. These 10 core concepts in our Hummingbird Hearts. So I had begun running those workshops, those ITF workshops in this co-working space as well. And I'd also filmed a music video two music videos for songs on the Hum record. So it was all, my sense of what I was doing at that time was like synergistic. This was his Dr. Calder's office. Here he is singing one of his songs in his office. And just around the corner here, you could come to this location to conduct an Integrate, Transform, Flourish workshop with Dr. Calder. And then that co-working location shut down, and because only 2 or 3 months before it shut down had I started renting an office and signed a lease for a year, I was offered an office at a different location, Capella Tower, locked in at that same rate. So the office that I had at Capella Tower was more like the size of this studio room.
Sure.
Yeah. And was high up in the skyscraper, looked down at this majestic view of U.S. Bank Stadium, for example. I could just about make out the Taylor Swift concert that was happening there when I was working in my office at night.
And I had visited you there. This is a really nice place. If you're going to write somewhere, like we said earlier, you could do this sitting on your bed, but There's an energetic value to space.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then, so that's again in this third time frame where that's where the Dr. Calder character is back from England and he thinks he's writing her Hummingbird Heart. But I'm still working in the service industry. I'm not working in academia anymore, and I have a smorgasbord of different jobs to enable me to pay rent even before there are these extra mouths to feed and so forth.
Yeah.
So one of my service industry jobs ends up being downtown at a restaurant cafe and in a different skyscraper. So I move my office across to Industrious where my service industry job is on the ground level of that skyscraper. And that moment is the closest to the present moment insofar as having all the systems in place and locking everything in. Because when Fiona and the kids would get up and go to school,
sure,
I would get up and I would get my good exercise, walk, even in the winter sometimes, walk to downtown where I would then work isolated on my writing in my Industrious office space for a few hours. Then I would go down to work my shift in the cafe. And then I would go up and I would get a few more hours done. Then I would walk home and I would do it. Essentially like a telemarketing job whilst working on my book in the afternoon. And then I would go and host karaoke. And it was a system that was exhausting, but that worked. Until one day I showed up for the service industry job and was at will terminated.
Sure.
On the grounds that I'd been making mistakes and there was no reference to what the mistakes were. And that just completely destroyed this system that I had constructed that was primarily to secure and protect my writing space. And I was still locked into having this office in a skyscraper that I no longer was making money in. And so fast forward, Dr. Kuhl, that's a large part of Dr. Kuhl's comedy of errors in the third time frame, trying and failing to set himself up for success to have this dedicated writing space. And weirdly, now, as established, the writing space is the same desk that I had been using in the previous attempt, which was at Buzzer Lofts. I had an apartment there, apartment unit there that I was using as a writing space. Now, just having that writing desk in the family kitchen, the current process, which is working better than any previous one, involves getting up at the same time as the rest of the family, feeling in alignment with them. We're a unit. And, you know, having coffee in bed with Fiona, maybe watching a bit of a TV show with Beatrice. And then they all go off to school. And if the kitchen is still a bit messy from either Fiona and I or I having cooked, or sometimes Beatrice these days, having cooked the previous evening, then I'll tidy everything up. I'll wash the dishes, put them away. I'll already have my intention for writing for the day. But as I'm simultaneously making the family's space functional for the family when they return home, I'm also making my what is for the duration of school time my writing space a writing space. And you know, I am one half of an events department at the Uptown VFW. I do have a lot of work, but I am very regimented in this respect regarding when I allow myself to do that work. And at the moment, writing is my primary work, even though it's not leading to any money yet. It's my primary work. And the self-publishing, really, just getting this work out and having it become a funnel to those ITF workshops and e-courses, if people are interested in the content. I'm not particularly interested in making a lot of money from the writing in and of itself. And if I feel like self-publishing, I am able to ensure that the material gets in the hands of the people that I feel might benefit from it, if they're interested. Sure. And then if those people want to make the commitments to themselves that the book advocates, then they can work with me either directly or with the, you know, the video versions of me through these writing exercises.
So we'll have the book, and then we'll have the accompanying workshops. There's going to be a revival of the in-person work that happens with you, the author, and it's a sort of resurgence of Dr. Simon Calder.
Yeah,
is it, or is that identity kind of left behind?
That's a really good question. So in the draft of the introduction that I shared with you before the interview, Dr. Simon R. Calder is, for the most part, a character that is being poked fun at a little in a loving way by present me. He's Dr. Simon R. Calder 2.0. And that Dr. Calder character, you know, is, without any context initially, we encounter him in his skyscraper office, and he's making a documentary about himself.
In his slightly crumpled gray blazer.
Yeah, which is, even at that point, you know, I have a sense that Dr. Calder does have a sense of humor, and he isn't just self-aggrandizing. But yeah, this crumpled gray blazer is kind of like a costume. It's that even then, consciously, that signifies the Dr. Calder character. But then we also, in that documentary, have a Cephas character who is a kind of alter ego. My friend Autumn was quick to highlight when I performed the songs that, you know, I had written as that character. She was like, "Simon, you're wearing a woman's bathrobe." Which was technically accurate, but that was the Cephas character, and I have found it healthy and life-serving and liberating to lean into these different aspects of oneself. Like the songs on the record Hum, I took a part of myself, exaggerated it, was calling that Cephas, which means Peter or stone, and that was fruitful. Conversely, at the moment, writing our Hummingbird Hearts as Simon, who, I am Dr. Calder, I have a PhD, that's not something that in my day-to-day life I really wear on my sleeves, but it's pertinent to this book because this book does integrate Transform Flourish. It does integrate this, specifically the scholarly habits that I cultivated in the decade that I spent at Cambridge, to my detriment to some extent, insofar as I was somewhat of a workaholic for some of that time. But there was life-serving value to the methodology, and some evolved more less scholarly, more life-serving form of that method is central to our Hummingbird Hearts.
I can relate to some of that in that I pursued higher education also. But when I was trying to squeeze all of my self-worth out of being Kirk Clocky, Robert Wood Johnson, Columbia Fellow of Medical and Scientific Journalism, the pressure was too great.
Yes.
And I couldn't perform to the level of the big title.
Yeah.
And when I lean into the character Kirk Clocky, who's a fishmonger at Hy-Vee in Brooklyn Park,
exactly,
who volunteers at KFAI, I feel much more successful because I'm able to deliver on each of those things
in a really good way.
And so I feel like what you've just described is something like that, where you adjust the identity to the level of work and pressure and achievement that you can realistically attain right now, given the current circumstances.
Yeah, and I've said to my family members, okay, I have this little bit of like real estate now in the kitchen, and it should be expected that at some point in the next few years, like at least some income stream is benefiting the family as a result of this little corner of the kitchen having become Dr. Calder's writing desk. And, you know, for the most part, as particularly as I'm writing the introduction and the early chapters of our Hummingbird Hearts, as that's what I'm refining at the moment, where they're the opening chapters on work, the second chapters on play, that's such a core transition to the book, and we get to encounter the Cambridge student Simon, who is very focused on work and not very reflective about the role of work within his life. The transition of that character into, first of all, Dr. Calder at the University of Minnesota, who spends most of his time exploring the music scene, and then later on, present me, who's like very family focused and very music focused, like running a nightclub. It's very, very different. At the moment, I have a very playful attitude towards Dr. Simon R. Calder, and he is kind of teased lovingly, definitely not in a shame inducing way. I do like my former self. But that's a key part of Integrate, Transform, Flourish. Those courses suggest that, you know, my core idea there in the acronym, in the name, is that the integration of different aspects of oneself needs to come prior to flourishing. The transformations that lead to being able to effectively sustain one's chosen commitments only comes as a result of making peace with oneself and loving all the different versions of oneself. So that's why it's so autobiographical, and that's why we have these four parallel time frames with essentially four different stories, where, of course, the first and the second and the third time frames in some way leading the character to become who he is in the later time frames. But we have these choice points, and we have these moments where there's a failure to come through with what one wants to do, and the most obvious option is her hummingbird heart.
I feel like the ability to not take oneself too seriously is actually a form of emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
And that people who take themselves way too seriously tend to not be very likable.
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, and if we're able to poke fun at some of the ridiculous aspects of being Dr. Simon Calder.
Yeah, especially when he's pontificating
at Cambridge. That's
in a skyscraper.
The reality of that life is not relatable to most people.
Right.
Which so is, the fact that we're able to make fun of it just a little bit, we'll rib him just a little bit.
Yeah.
Then we can have this whole lighthearted thing about him making these little appearances here and there in his gray coat to keep us on track.
And by now it's so grubby. Whenever I wear it, like that's the first thing that people highlight. It's like when Autumn highlighted, Simon, you're wearing a woman's bathrobe. Rather than people giving Dr. Calder due reverence, they're like, that's a pretty grubby blazer.
Well, maybe we'll get it cleaned for you at some point.
But he's been through it. Dr. Calder's been through it. But actually, so spoiler alert, when people eventually read A Hummingbird Heart, it does involve a marriage, a wedding, which is still in the future at the moment, but Fiona and I are engaged. And one of the things that I will acquire a new suit for the wedding, which Fiona encourages me to then, post-wedding, it will become my new Dr. Calder suit, and it won't be grubby, and it will be similar. And I like that it will integrate the family man, husband character, because I think it probably will be the case that the author of Our Hummingbird Hearts is Dr. Simon R. Calder still. But it's fun that it will be an interesting aspect of the read. That for the first few chapters, at least, Dr. Calder just seems to be a character in the novel, in the book, that is one of the less appealing characters, actually, that we enjoy kind of poking fun at a bit.
Well, I think that's about all the time we have today, but we're definitely going to continue this conversation as the project unfolds. Would you be willing to come back sometime?
Dr. Calder, Dr. Simon R. Calder shall return.
Ah, yes. And I like that Dr. Calder sprinkles his street cred in here and there, like sprinkles on the cake where necessary, but he doesn't put it out there in a way that separates him from the herd.
I love the herd. I'm a herd animal.
So thank you again. Thank you, Simon, for joining us, telling us about the evolution, the unfolding of Our Hummingbird Heart. And hope to see you again next time.
I'd love to be back. That's
great. You've been listening to 90.3 KFAI FM in the Twin Cities and streaming online at kfai.org. My name is Kirk Clocky. I was the producer of this episode. Special thanks to the staff at KFAI for their support. And I hope you will join us again next week, 7 p.m. Central Time in the Twin Cities, for Right on Radio. I don't know what good words will do, but if someone's drunk, we could just